Today is September 3rd, 2021. This is an oral history interview with Carl Santone, who was a former operator at the SM-1A reactor facility at Fort Greely, Alaska. We are conducting this interview over the phone. We have two interviewers and one narrator. So just briefly, we'll state our names and current locations, and then we'll get started. I am Patience Stewart. I'm a historian, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Kevin?
And this is Kevin Taylor. I am a nuclear engineer and health physicist calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
And Carl?
Carl Santone, retired military, retired attorney, former operator at the SM-1A, and I'm talking from my home in Gordonsville, Virginia.
Great, thank you. I think that's the most formal, official part of the interview, so I hope that everyone can just feel like we're having a conversation from here. As we document the interview on the website, what is your full name as you would like it seen?
Carl L. Santone, and you can just call me Carl.
Okay, great. And could you state the dates that you worked at SM-1A?
I believe it was from 1960, probably in around January or February, until 1962. I was only there for 18 months. I was the only single member of the crew, and so my tour was for 18 months as opposed to 2 years for everybody else.
And what rank or title did you have while you were there?
I was a specialist six, and I had volunteered to go to Fort Greely.
Okay, could you tell us a little about the series of events that brought you there?
Well, I had applied to the Army Nuclear Power Program and was accepted in the class of 59-2, which started in September of 1959. The academic course and training course was combined about a year in length. And I worked at the SM-1 for about 6 months after I graduated from the school. And that was when I then went up to Fort Greely. My training was in operations, and also I was a health physics specialist.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the training process of SM-1, if you remember?
Probably not. Bear in mind, this was over 60 years ago, and although I do recall what I had for breakfast, don't ask me what I ate yesterday morning for breakfast.
That is fine. You don't have to answer anything.
I'm now 84 years old, and I've done a lot since I was with the reactor program.
Great.
So, basically, the academic course was some physics, some math, a lot of technical subjects. We were all enlisted men, and virtually none of us had any college to speak of. I think I had about a year at that time. So we were taught by, actually most of them were West Point graduates. They were captains and majors who were assigned to the nuclear power program, and they taught the classes. The technical classes, the operator training, of course, was done by previous graduates from the operator course. The officers who taught the classes probably didn't know that much about actually operating a reactor. They could tell you what some of the formulas were, but how to apply them was beyond them.
Sounds like it was necessary to have the multi-part then have for some graduates of the program that were part of your training. Do you remember how big the group was in your training cohort?
Our class was probably about 45 to 50 people.
Okay. And then do you recall how many of you?
We had some who dropped out, and we had one poor guy who died of a heart attack. The reactor was at the bottom of a very long hill. The classrooms were at the top of the hill, and we'd have to go back and forth. He was considerably overweight, and unfortunately, halfway up the hill one day, he just collapsed and died.
Oh, wow. That's quite tragic.
And then a few people did drop out of the program or flunked out. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall how... Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to ask Carl if he, while he was at SM1, if he was an operator there as well, or if he just did his training there.
I was an operator there and then also worked as a health physicist.
Okay.
Everybody had cross-training. There were specialties, and I think it was electronics, mechanics, electrical, and health physics. And not being very mechanically inclined, I opted for health physics.
What were some of the duties associated with that, with being a health physicist?
Run chemical analyses of the water in both primary and secondary systems, decontamination, you know, just generally looking for purple bubbles.
Carl, are you aware that the decommissioning process for the SM1 reactor has started?
Yes, I'm part of their stakeholder group on that one, too, and I'm keep getting updates on it.
Okay, great.
It's kind of depressing that most of the places I've worked are now museums. Before I went to the reactor program, I was in Berlin, and this has been declassified now, so I can talk about it. We dug a tunnel under the East Berlin border and tapped into the telephone lines between Berlin and Moscow. And that has now become part of the spy museum in Washington.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
So you said that your group was about 40 to 45 people. Do you recall how many of you were sent to Fort Greely?
I was the only one in my class who went to Fort Greely. Everybody else was in a previous class.
When you got there, was there additional training, or did you jump into...
Well, it was still under construction at that time, so there couldn't be much training, obviously. But once the construction was complete, there was some additional operator training. And before that, there were supposed to be some radiochemistry tests conducted to form baseline for the later studies. Unfortunately, Peter Kiewit, who was the constructor, the contractor, didn't have anybody to do the health physics study, radiochemistry study, I'm sorry. And so I was asked to do that, and I did. So I spent probably a week or two doing radiochemistry to establish baseline data. I also worked with with a warrant officer who was assigned there, helping him put together an after-action report and a manual for the operation of the reactor.
Now, when you say you were doing radiochemistry to establish baseline, were you looking at environmental baselines or other factors?
No, the fluids that were in the reactor itself, once they activated the primary system and the secondary systems, they took samples of the water that they were using, and I did studies on those.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about can you tell us a little bit about the construction and when you got there and the stage of construction and what you did as far as that, in between the time from construction to startup?
Yeah, I really just don't recall.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Many, many years, long before you were born, probably.
Yes, sir.
Sure. So once the reactor was up and operating, could you tell us what you remember about your day-to-day activities?
Generally, just operation of the reactor. Our training had been on the SM1, which, of course, was very similar. But on the SM1, we did scram exercises and, put in bugs in the system and then tried to correct them and so forth. Once we got to the SM1A, its function was to operate and provide electricity for the base and some of the surrounding community at certain times. So essentially you sat there and watched dials, and as opposed to being physically involved with doing a lot of the operating. Once the reactor was up and providing steam, the generator and the started running, and then you sat there and watched it. It was very boring.
Now, the reactor that time was also providing direct steam to heat the base and run the laundry. Is that correct?
I don't remember that at all. Okay. I remember reading about it, but I was there for just a couple of months after the reactor, after the system was up and running. My time ran out, and I wasn't about to stay any longer than necessary. Being a single man in Fort Greely was not pleasant. I think I had one date the whole time I was there. There were no single women.
Other than that, what was it like living up there? Did you live on base or in?
Yeah, I was on base. I lived in the barracks. Unfortunately, I had a private room. But there really wasn't much to do. They had a very good library, and I read extensively. Used to go fishing, ice fishing in the winter, and down to Valdez in the summer and spring. But, when you had to drive 150 miles to Fairbanks for any nightlife, you didn't go very often.
Pretty quiet up there. Do you remember the initial startup of the reactor?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I was on, they tried to limit the number of people in the control room, obviously. And everybody wanted to be there, but we had to draw straws for times when we were allowed in and watch somebody with a good deal more experience actually do work.
Sure. How many people were on the shifts on a normal day?
About three.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, we had two guards, which I found very strange. Two young enlisted men who provided security for the reactor. Not that we needed much. We were on an army base. But I always found that strange. We never had much security at the SM-1.
I participated in several of these interviews with operators from the SM-1, and that was, we were discussing, all the activity that went on there with the training and all the instructors and everything. So once you got to SM-1A, it seems like it was pretty quiet.
Yes, because, that wasn't that much activity. And then when I left the SM-1A, I went back to the SM-1 and became an operator shift supervisor there. And, of course, there was a lot more activity. So most of my memories are with the SM-1, putting bugs in the system and teaching a new crop of students how to react and how to correct the situation. I did go back to the SM-1A, I think it was in 1964. I'm not sure. It was the first refueling, and they were having some problems. And I was sent back up for some ungodly reason. I helped with the fuel and got overdosed once. And that was the end of my participation up there.
Could you tell us?
Can you tell us the? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, could you explain the refueling process to us?
The primary system was open and depressurized completely. The lid was removed, and then he manually took out fuel rods. Unfortunately, as I recall, I think the one that caused me to be overexposed was a little bit difficult to get out, and it moved more than it should have. And I think I got three rounds, which hasn't ever caused me any problems. I probably isn't that much. The poor guys in Idaho got a lot more than that. I'm sure you know about the SL1 incident.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and then the only other contact I had with the reactor program, once I got back down to the SM1, I worked there for a little while as a shift supervisor, and then went into the administrative side of things. And about that time, they were deactivating the reactor in Greenland, and they were going to bring the fuel back to the United States. I helped with the design and construction of the casks, the spent fuel casks that were manufactured in Baltimore. And I went up there about twice a week for a good 3 months working on the casks. And then I escorted the spent fuel back from Greenland, from Thule, back to the United States on a Liberty ship. It was kind of amusing because we had some really bad weather, and the fuel casks were up on the deck of the Liberty ship. They didn't put them in the hold. And we hit rough weather, and the fuel casks were bouncing around. And the captain told me I didn't need to worry about it because everything was fine. They had a good, strong deck. And he says, by the way, how much do the fuel casks weigh? And I say, told him that each one of them weighed 7 tons. And he turned kind of pale. And they tightened them down a little bit. They didn't bounce around on the deck anymore.
So, did you have any other experience with the Sturgis or any of the other military reactors?
No, I was never on the Sturgis. A lot of my friends were. I saw it from a distance in Mobile once. I was on my way to OCS. I left the program. And I was visiting some friends who were on the Sturgis, and I saw it from a distance, but that was about it. I didn't have any involvement with it.
For the purpose of the recording, and because a lot of the people that will listen to it may know very little about reactors, do you think you could describe the process?
I think I would embarrass myself if I tried at this point.
Right.
It's just been too long. I've done a great deal in between, I don't think I'd be a good source to try to explain it to anybody.
Okay.
Well, tell us about how your experience in the Army Reactor Program, where did that take you? What did you gain from that, and how did it help you as you advanced in your career and your life?
Yeah. Actually, it didn't. It had no impact on anything I did after I left the program. I went to OCS at Fort Benning, and then I got assigned to Germany. From there, I went to Vietnam. From Vietnam, I went to Iran. After I went to Air Command and Staff College, for some reason, I don't know why, Army, not Air Force, I was assigned to Sinkland, and I got a feeling that the government was trying to tell me something. So I retired and went to law school. I worked as a trial lawyer for 30 years. And I never had any further contact with anything. I did keep in touch with one or two people in the program. And some of them because of the, I don't know if you know about the Nuclear Support Service Company that was formed by some of the former members.
Yes.
It's now defunct, and I was an investor and lost a bunch. But other than that, I think the only people I've kept in contact with at all were Ed Fiedel. He may be a good source for you to talk to. And Charlie Harmon, of course, the officer in charge of the SM1A. We ran into each other in Vietnam and had lunch. He was an aide to General Abrams, and I was an aide to General Williamson, who was the CG of the 25th Division. So we met and talked briefly about the reactor group. And then I ran into him again in 19... I guess it was 73. I had come back to the States to go to Command and General Staff College, and he was at the assistant commandant at Fort Belvoir. and I saw him again briefly then. But other than that, I've not kept in touch with anybody in the program.
You had mentioned previously that you were the youngest member of the first team of operators at SM1A. Do you remember much about the culture and camaraderie among the team?
Well, Friday night happy hours were a biggie, but other than that, there was not a lot of... The other people were all married, and they had social lives. Obviously, being a young bachelor, I wasn't included that often. So I really don't know. Have you talked to any of the other people from the SM1A? I don't know if many of them probably I know are not still alive. Sergeant Hildreth, I know, died. He was the senior NCO. Ernie Audette and Dick Schultz, some of the people I met at the reunion about 30 years ago, but the reunions are becoming pretty slim. So many of the people came into the program after I left. I don't even know them.
None of those names are people that we've talked to. I've spoken with George Shaw, who was in the first group of Alaska civilian operators that were trained. Bill Hellams and David Appleby.
None of those names are familiar to me at all.
Okay. And then...
So they came after me, I guess.
And then, Kevin, I know you've previously talked to Billy Joe Foreman and Frank Faulkner. Do those names sound familiar?
That's right.
Yes.
You know, Faulkner might be... he may have been one of my students at the SM1. I'm not sure.
I recall there was one of the gentlemen I spoke with that was at SM1 who mentioned that he too was the youngest in a particular group, and he was the only bachelor. But I guess in Virginia things were a little easier, and the married men were always trying to set him up with other women. But as you mentioned earlier, there weren't a whole lot in Delta Junction to.
The young lady that I dated was Miss Delta Junction, which was not difficult because she was the only one in contention.
So when you told your family and friends that you were headed to Alaska, to the middle of nowhere in Alaska, to run a nuclear reactor, what did they think?
I'm from a military family, so nobody thought anything about it. I had lived in Korea as a child when my father was assigned there. That was the end of the world, too, at that time. We left Korea on the second evacuation before the war started. So my going to Alaska was no big deal to any of them.
Did it feel like a big deal to you?
I guess the fact that you were working in nuclear power, that didn't have, there was no having any issues with that, or any of your family members that worried them?
I'm not sure they even understood what it was. Not terribly sophisticated. And it didn't bother any of them, the fact that I was working with radiation.
Do you remember much about the popular opinion about nuclear power during that time?
No, there didn't seem to be. There was one lady at Fort Belvoir. She lived on the other side of Gunston Cove from the SM1, and she kept complaining that the radiation was causing the paint on her house to blister and peel off. Everybody thought that was pretty funny. But there were no protests against nuclear power or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. I've actually heard about that lady before. I think she also complained about her flowers dying and things like that.
She was quite a nutcase, yes.
Was there much said on the...
I'm assuming she's not around anymore.
Was there much said kind of from the other angle? Was nuclear power being promoted widely?
Well, we in the military certainly thought it would be a good thing because of, the having to transport fuel to these out-of-the-way places, you know, huge numbers of barrels of oil and so forth. Yeah, we thought it would be a pretty good deal. And it was a pretty good deal for enlisted military, too. You were kind of a special group. You had to go through a rigorous selection process. So, we were pretty proud of ourselves, but didn't have that much to do with the nuclear reactor aspect.
It's a pretty elite, intellectually elite group to be a part of.
Right, yeah. They were pretty bright people. They were, I must admit, some of them were absolutely brilliant. A guy named Lee Taylor, for example. I don't know if you're not related to ISM, but Lee D. Taylor was probably the smartest person I've ever met, and very humble. You'd never know it.
Did you know him at Belvoir, Fort Belvoir?
At SM-1, yeah.
At SM-1, yeah.
No, he was not on the SM-1A. Okay.
So if
any unusual events other than your mishap with the refueling that you recall? Anything that kind of made you pause while you were either SM-1 or SM-1A and made you think that this wasn't for you?
No, it was much colder at Fort Greely than I had anticipated. I did get frostbite. But then I had problems in Vietnam, too. I got jungle rot on my feet as well there. So my podiatrist gets a big kick out of the fact that I'm the only one she's ever treated who had both frostbite and jungle rot.
you did say you arrived there in January or December, and I've been there in both times.
It's very cold.
Quite a shock.
67 below for a week there straight, and I thought, good Lord, what have I gotten into? But you adapt. But no, I got bored with the power program itself. I thought I could do better, and did. So
when you left the power program, you did not make any transition out of the nuclear power program to the Army's power program when they started focusing more on diesel power generation.
Oh no.
Okay.
You had moved on.
I went to infantry OCS just in time for the Vietnam buildup. Power was the least of my concerns at that time.
Now, you had mentioned that you had an overexposure during the refueling, and you said you got 3 shots. Could you just talk a little bit about what that all means? Explain how an overexposure would occur, and then what would be how it was monitored and what was done about it?
Well, we were wearing dosimeters at the time, and the dosimeter just exceeded its capability, so we never really knew exactly how much of an overexposure we had. It was estimated at about 3 rems, but we were followed carefully after that with body scans and so forth, but I never had any repercussions from it. My wife jokes that that's the reason we don't have children. I don't think so.
Were the body scans done at SM-1A?
Oh, no. No, that has to be done at, I think it was Walter Reed. No, it was the Naval Hospital in D.C. But it was pretty much hushed up. Nobody really wanted to talk about it. And I... and therefore, probably shouldn't talk about it now.
Okay. Do you have any other memories about things that happened while you were at SM-1A?
Not really. I'm sorry that I can't be more help to you, but you should have called me 50 years ago. Now that I'm in my mid-80s, as I said, your short-term memory goes. The long-term memory is supposed to be better, but not that long-term.
Sure. Kevin, do you have any additional questions?
I do not. I just thank Carl for his participation and his service in the service to our country. It seems like you had a very long service, and certainly appreciate that.
You're welcome. I'm sure I couldn't be more help.
Oh, I think this was incredibly helpful. It was really great to hear about your experiences. And if there's anything else you'd like to share, please do. But I think we've got a lot of good information.
After I retired from practicing law, actually while I was still practicing law, my wife and I formed a rescue group for the local shelters where we live. There are five of them that were putting down dogs and cats right and left. And in the last, for 20 years, we took out 6,000 dogs and cats and found them homes. And I've still got a few left if you want one.
Wow.
Well, I appreciate that as well as the owner of a rescue dog, but I think one's enough for me right now.
You don't want any of my pit bulls, huh?
No, thank you. I appreciate it, though.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for asking me to participate. I hope you can get something out of it, but be sure to clean it up.
Absolutely. I'll be in contact with you after the interview. Make sure that you get a copy of the recording, and we'll put together a short bio for you to add to the Juke Digest, or the Project Jukebox website.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. We'll go ahead and end the interview now. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you, sir.